Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Detroit, Michigan, and earned a Bachelor of General Studies in Business from the University of Michigan while playing football, and later a law degree from the University of Notre Dame. He played guard in the NFL for 7 seasons, and in 1992 he founded Life Athletes, a pro-life and pro-sexual abstinence before marriage organization. A nationally renowned author and speaker, his name, Chris Godfrey. And we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible, a News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Crisula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to the nationally renowned author and speaker, Chris Godfrey. Chris, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thanks, Jack. It's great to be with you.
Can we start by talking about your childhood, growing up in Detroit, and your mom and your dad, please?
Well, sure. Yeah, we grew up on the Lower East Side, and through the 60s and early 70s, and it was a wonderful, almost idyllic sort of childhood, in the sense that we lived about a half a block from the church. And within that one block or so, there must have been eight or nine large families, and the kids, we all kind of ran around like the little rascals in the up and down the schoolyard, the alleys, and in the neighboring environs. And it was really a great beginning. And but then things kind of changed in Detroit thereafter, and then the neighborhood started to change, and we ended up actually moving out middle of my junior year when Dad took a transfer within his company and moved down to Florida. But have some very happy memories of enjoying growing up in Detroit. In fact, my mother just recounted one the other day, a memory where, "I can't believe I let you and your buddy just go to Babalo one day." We were just some young lads, but we just jumped on the bus, went downtown, took the Babalo boat, actually came back much later than my mom expected to know where we were. But we made it back safely, and so it was a fun time, and provides me many happy memories.
What's the biggest thing you learned from Mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from Dad?
Oh, the biggest thing I learned from Mom, I think, was my piety, in the sense of being prayerful and impatient. Although that's not one that I've learned well, but I know it's a beautiful virtue to have, as exhibited by my mom. But she was always a thoughtful, spiritual, prayerful sort of a person, and that is something that is that taught me well and has been kind of a source of strength through my life. Dad, on the other hand, I learned integrity and the willingness to do what's right, even when it's difficult. And he was not a scholar, but he wasn't unintelligent. But his greatest intelligence was his emotional intelligence, which is a far greater indication to success, as the researchers would say. And that would be the ability to, put off immediate gratification, to do something difficult in order to reap bigger benefits in the future. And for my dad, that was his faith and family and doing what's right, and, sometimes butting heads against those who would be more powerful or better positioned than yourself, because it was the right thing to do. And that's something that I'll always know him for, and something I actually thanked him for when he retired from his career many years ago.
You go to the University of Michigan, you earn a degree, and you play football for the legendary coach Bo Schembechler. What made Bo so special?
I think the thing that made Bo so special was his sense of integrity. He had a reputation for meaning what he said, and I can't believe that it was totally undeserved. I was just a dumb kid, but I always had a great deal of respect for him because of that, and his willingness to roll up his sleeves and to do it. And that is something that I'll always remember him for. He also had a great sense of humor. And, of course, everybody knows he could be stubborn at times, you know, kind of digging his heels. And I think he would be the first to admit that. But I was the beneficiary of him running a program based upon those sorts of values. And those values are hard to find. And because of that, we had really an exceptional, or he had quite an exceptional program for many, many years. And I had no idea that I was really there during the first half of his long career. We were there at the tail end of his first 10 years. And we're very much the beneficiary of his vision and hard work and the staff that he put around him. And now, being in, long in the tooth, look back, and we can see that those were really some golden years for Michigan football, and to have been a part of that is really special.
You played on three U of M Rose Bowl teams, albeit you didn't win any, but what's it like going to Pasadena, playing in the Rose Bowl, and that famous flyover before the game?
Yeah, that was really, really special. The Rose Bowl, as you mentioned, was always the gold standard, the great reward for having a great season. And unfortunately, each of the three times we went there, we ended up on the short end of the score for various reasons. And Bo tried his best to fix them. Couldn't fix some of those bad calls, Charles Davis dropping the ball on the two-yard line and still getting 6 points out of the deal, things like that. But when I had the opportunity to play professional football, and when the Giants actually won the spot for the NFC in Super Bowl 21, we were returning to the Rose Bowl, and what a great thrill that was. And I'll never forget one of the great little lead-in stories of the whole thing was, which Wolverine was finally going to win in the Rose Bowl. You see, the Denver Broncos had my former teammate Mike Harden on the roster, and Mike and I both suffered through those three defeats, and we each had another chance at it. And unfortunately, I came up on the winning end of that one. But the spectacle was much as I remembered it, and with the addition of a great flyover and all the rest. And we'll never forget, the New York Giant fans will never forget, the whole stadium chanting New York, New York, as we took the field that second half and came back from a 2-point deficit to really run over the Denver Broncos in the second half, which reminds me of a great analogy that was the late Charles Murray, the great L.A. sports reporter, said about the Super Bowl contest, and he was responding to people expressing disappointment at how many of them were lopsided. And he says, well, their disappointment is due to the fact that they're looking at it the wrong way. These are really heavyweight fights, and they're going to slug and punch each other, and sooner or later a punch is going to land in just the right spot, and somebody's going to go down and go down big. And I thought that really described our battle aptly. And so it was a great thrill, and it was a great thrill to be a part of a team that's, you know, New York had been really starving for a champion for many, many years. And to be the beneficiary of their gratitude and continuing gratitude. It's always fun going back to New York because people still remember that game, and it's a big part of their family tradition, and they'll never forget this or that. And so it's a lot of fun. Really blessed to have been part of that.
We're talking to Chris Godfrey. When we come back, we'll find out, after he left U of M, he was not drafted. He signed with the Redskins as a free agent. We'll find out what happened to him. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything is Possible. I'm Jack Prisula, and we're with Chris Godfrey, who in 1992 founded Life Athletes, a pro-life and pro-sexual abstinence before marriage organization. Chris, you get out of U of M, 1980. You're not drafted. You sign with the Redskins as a free agent. What happened?
Well, I had an opportunity to play in the NFL. I can't say that it was a lifelong ambition, but when I got to that point, I really wanted to play. And so I worked my tail off. I put on 20 pounds. I lifted all day long, ran all day long. And so when I got to the training camp, I was in the best shape of my life. And it's really the coach's dream. Gave every play of every practice 110%. You know, training camps in the NFL back then were no day at the beach. Back then, before the salary cap, they would just work you to death, and training camps would be almost 2 months long. And you just thought it was never going to end. But I stayed with it, and by the end of the preseason, the local media and some of my teammates were talking about how I was going to make the team. You know, quite the long shot, but I was having that kind of a camp. And then, quite unexpectedly, I got a call from an assistant coach one morning telling me I was cut. It was right before the final cut there. And like I said, it was unexpected. In fact, I even had a quarterback sack in the last preseason game. I figured I'd sealed a spot on the roster with that one. And so when I got cut, I was just crushed. It was so unfair. And apparently, you know, you might remember the Redskins had a bunch of really old players called the Over the Hill Gang that George Allen had assembled. And they were great players in their heyday, and they were good guys and quite the characters, too. But one of them became the head coach. And so he was coaching his buddies. So there was a little bit of, you know, the familiarity of working with your friends and versus bringing on some new guys. And I think I got the short end of the stick on that one. And so I came home, and I was really crushed by the experience. And it was so unfair. You know, it's just kind of like you work, you do everything that you can possibly do, and by all objective standards, you should have achieved what you were working towards, but you don't get it. And that's where I was at.
A year later, Chris, you try again, this time with the Green Bay Packers, and once again, you're the last cut. What did you do when Bart Starr told you you're cut?
Well, when I got that phone call, and that was a week after I was told I made the team, and I was in a hotel room, so it was kind of like a wake-up call. I kind of get over to the phone first thing in the morning and stumble over there, and I get that news. And I can remember just hanging up the phone and falling to my knees and praying. I said, "Lord, I give up. You know, whatever you want me to do, wherever you want me to go, you're the boss now." And I never prayed like that before. And, you know, whether I had a big decision to make, you know, whether to do things my way or to do things God's way, I usually found a way to rationalize doing it my way. But this time was different. It was quite obvious to me at that point that my way wasn't working, and I was willing to try anything, even God's way. And that's where I was at. So I packed up my bags. I checked out of the Midway Motor Lodge across the street from Lambeau Field, where the Packers locker room is. So I go over to the locker room, I clean out my locker, I had my final physical, and I'm heading out the front door to jump in my car to drive home back to Detroit, when Bart Starr, the head coach, called me into his office and apologized for cutting me and asked me to stay. And I was flabbergasted. You know, I'd been around the NFL long enough to know that they just didn't make dumb mistakes like that. You know, every night they're watching film and they're evaluating talent, figuring out who's going to fill what spot on the roster, and there aren't very many spots on the roster. And I just knew that I knew that God had a hand in the whole thing. Let me get cut. Let me know that I wasn't as great as I thought I was. But also give me my job back to let me know that he cared for me. And then just show me that he was close to me. And because he was close to me, I wanted to get closer to him.
You then went to the USFL. And after a couple years, you signed in 94 with the New York Giants and the legendary coach Bill Parcells. Tell us about Hall of Fame coach Bill Parcells.
Well, I remember one of the first meetings that we had. And I think it really it really captured an important aspect of him. In between my my stay with the Redskins and Packers, I spent a year with the New York Jets, backing up their New York Sack Exchange. And we went, the first 13 games that season, we didn't win a game. And the New York press ate us alive. You can imagine how bad it was. You know, that we played in Shea Stadium, and they had banners hanging off the balconies saying our coach was named Walt Michaels, and there was a big banner one day that said, stick an apple in Walt's mouth. He's a pig. I mean, it was just bad. And they would have stuff in the sporting sections, polls about how bad we were. And so when I signed with the Giants coming back, those were my memories of playing in New York. And the Giants only won 3-2 the year before. And so I was prepared for the worst. And one of our first preseason meetings, Bill Parcells, who had just come off that 3-win season, this was now his second year, the way he addressed the issue of dealing with the press and how we should respond and all of the rest, I can't remember anything verbatim, but I remember coming out of that meeting with a strong sense of, like, we're in good hands here. You know, we've got a New Jersey wise guy to handle all these other wise guys for us. And that became kind of one of his hallmarks of coaching, and that was the way that he dealt with the press, and doing it almost in a way that created a safe haven for his players. And he would create the controversy himself and draw the fire and let us play the game. And so that was great. And then in this little bubble that he created for us, this team, he would enjoy needling us and coming up with nicknames for us and bantering back and forth with us in the huddle. And I really appreciated his sense of humor and his wit. And I think those would be good ways to remember him, as well as being a hard guy. I mean, but I don't remember him as being a hard-nosed coach as much as I remember him just being an intelligent but a regular guy.
January 21st, 1987, he leads you to Super Bowl 21 victory, 39-20 over the Broncos. So four times, Chris, you went to the Rose Bowl to play. Three with Michigan, one for a Super Bowl. The first three, you flew back after a loss. The fourth time, you experienced victory. What's it like flying back after a loss versus that flying back after that Super Bowl win?
Well, a much younger guy coming back after those losses, and so you're just seeing the world in a very different way. You hate losing, but even more than that, you hate disappointing your coach. and you really don't look forward to the spring practice to follow that. But you know, we really enjoyed going out there, and we did not like losing, and we felt like, you know, we could play with these guys, but there was something that was missing, perhaps, and I think they've since fixed that. You got to remember, we're from the Midwest, having to go out there 2 weeks beforehand, dealing with all the distractions involved, and everybody else that we played against was basically playing a home game. So we were down in the mouth, but we're young and really resilient, so, you know, just dumb college guys, you know, life is full. But coming back after winning the Super Bowl, you know, you're a professional now, you've been playing for a long time, trying your best to compete and succeed at the most difficult sport to do this because of the competition, because of the nature of the competition, because of the nature of the sport being so demanding physically, mentally, emotionally, and all of that, to achieve all of that and come and arrive at a point where there's nothing else to do, that you've achieved this, it is now locked in time, and you'll have it forever, and I'm speaking of this now many, many years later, it's an accomplishment that's there and can't be diminished and can't go away. And it almost becomes an asset, if you will, this wonderful memory. And so all of that was terribly fulfilling, and all of that became a stepping stone to everything that I did after that as well.
We're talking to Chris Godfrey in 1992. He formed Life Athletes. When we come back, we'll talk to him about that. And I'm Jack Rasool, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Prasula, and we're with Chris Godfrey, who founded Life Athletes, a pro-life and pro-sexual abstinence before marriage organization in 1992. Chris, you've got 4 points. What are they?
Well, I tried to use my professional background as a point of interest in getting young people's attention, and to use it for something more than just, you know, talking about sports scores, but to talk about something a little more lasting, something higher, if you will. And that became what Life Athletes, or became Life Athletes, and everything that we do in Life Athletes can be directed towards inviting young people to join us in making the Life Athletes commitment. You know, join us other professional Olympic athletes in making this commitment. And there are 4 points to it. I'll try to do what's right, even when it's difficult. I'll give myself only to that special person who I marry as my partner for life. I will respect the lives of others, especially the unborn and the aged. And I won't quit or make excuses when I fail. I'll try again. And that last point's really important because we've all done things we wish we hadn't have done. And we'll probably drop the ball sometime in the future, too. But the key is not to give up. You know, any good coach will tell you the only difference between a winner and a loser is that a winner gets up again after they lose. Okay, they don't just lay there and say, woe is me, I'll never be any good, and give up. Okay, I mean, that's what the devil wants you to do, is to take yourself out of the game. So we encourage young people to stick with it and to get back up again, dust yourself off, and keep trying. And that's the only way that you're going to get what it is that you're after, and that's a happy life.
Us Cubs fans have been getting up every day for 108-plus years,
yeah.
And this is the year. One of your mantras is, that's where I live. You say, the family is the strongest team on earth. That's where I live. Please.
And by good example, we are pointing in that direction for others to follow. And we try to emulate the virtues that we espouse. But at the same time, are quite clear that we're not perfect, but we are trying. And we recognize this as the truth, and we're going to do our best to live according to it. And the family is the strongest team on earth. A husband and a wife committed to one another for life is the source of happiness, because it's an image, it's a mirror of the relationship that God has with all of us.
Another one, where faith is armor, that's where I live. Please.
Yeah, faith is armor because it as the scripture says, it extinguishes all these, you know, kind of half-baked ideas that are floating around us, and there are more and more of them all the time because we have a very proficient mass media that gets things out very quickly and very frequently. And so how are we going to judge what's good and what's bad? And it's faith, upon which is what we hold and stand upon. And it's this faith that gives us hope of achieving what it is that we're after. Because one of the downsides of living at a time when perhaps nothing seems certain or secure or lasting forever, that just leads to despair and giving up, and what's the hope? If I can't see that I'm going to have a happy ending here, why even make the effort to go after it? And it's hope that helps us stay in the game, and that hope is based upon a sure faith, and a faith that's reasonable. We can think about it. We can reason to it. It's not superstition, okay? And so that's what we mean by faith being armor.
If you want to learn more, www.lifeathletes.org. You talk a lot, Chris, about taking responsibility. Please.
Well, responsibility is being answerable for your actions. It's also being responsible for your relationships. And, you know, we're born into relationships. We're not just, you know, to go way back into the philosophers who talk about, you know, we're born into this hurly-burly world where it's dog-eat-dog, you know. That's not really the case. You know, we're born into relationships, we're born into families, and that's how we learn what it means to be a human being. We learn from others and within these relationships, and we say that these relationships are the key to our happiness. Having good relationships is the key to our happiness, because it's only within them that we find love. You know, St. Paul says only three things last forever: faith, hope, and love. And of these three, the most excellent is love. And love can only be found within relationships. So everything that we aspire to achieve is good relationships. And in the sporting world, you know, it's sports demands much of you to be successful. And many of these good habits or virtues, if you will, that we learn playing sports can be applied towards good relationships. You know, getting up after you have a mistake, make a mistake, persevering, being a good teammate, you know, being a good friend is not too unlike being a good spouse or husband or wife or father or mother. And so all of these things can be translated, but to their very highest use is within the family, within this marriage relationship, and within this relationship that we have with God.
Chris, for the last 24 years, you and your team at Life Athletes have focused on reaching millennials and now Gen Zers. Let's say you buy a one-minute ad during next year's Super Bowl, and you talk to parents about teenagers and young adults today. What do you tell those parents in 1 minute?
Well, I think I would tell them that what you want to do is you want to be good parents, but you don't feel like you're disqualified by being a good parent because you're not the best parent. Okay? The mere fact that you are trying to do what's right, although imperfectly, admittedly imperfectly, your kids will know if you're trying or not, right? Kids are very perceptive, and that will teach them more than anything else that you could say, okay? And so I would want to encourage parents that only they can do what needs to be done. It can't be shuffled off to some government agency or even well-meaning people. You have the most important role to play in your kid's life. And in fact, all the sociologists, you know, as they examine, you know, how to define a Gen Zer versus a millennial and all these other things, so it all boiled down to the fact that kids want to know how you feel about them doing different things that you would consider negative or positive, and knowing how you feel about it will play the biggest role in their lives or have the biggest impact on their decisions regarding those issues. So parents are key. I mean, they're the owners, coaches, and press the whole thing, everything that cocoon that player, that kid of theirs lives in. And a championship team requires all of those things, doing their best and being coordinated. And that's something that parents can do.
We're talking to Chris Godfrey. If you want to learn more, www.lifeathletes.org. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything is Possible, and we're talking to the founder of Life Athletes. He and his team for the last 24 years have focused on reaching young people to talk to them about pro-life and pro-sexual abstinence before marriage. I had Chris a couple years ago on, a doctor who was an expert in family rearing. And at the end of the show, I said, if you could give young people one piece of advice, what would it be? She said, forget yourself. If there's a young person listening today that says, Chris Godfrey, my whole life is me. I don't know how to forget myself. What would you tell him or her?
Well, the best model we have of forgetting ourselves, or in other words, giving the best of ourselves, which is the definition of virtue that we've been talking about, the best role model is right before us, and unfortunately, his example gets marred by arguments and bad examples presented by others, and it sounds formulaic, and I hate to sound like I'm just offering cliches, but when it comes down to it, however you slice and look at it, is Jesus, you know, God himself, is our best example of how to give the best of yourself, to forget yourself for the sake of others. And that's the secret of finding the happiness that you're built to look for and built for wanting. And deep down, that's what it is that's driving all of us. And so we have to use our heads. We got to, you know, God made human beings different from all the rest of creation. And one of those characteristics that's different is that he gave us the ability to think, you know, an intellect. And he also gave us the great freedom to be able to choose whether or not to follow, you know, the truth as we discover it or not. And part of that is having the freedom to choose and to think about these things yourself. And not everybody is going to agree upon what's true. And so we need to give each other space as we sincerely try to follow the truth. But we can't be like a basketball player just dribbling all over the court just for the sake of dribbling. You know, we're dribbling down the court in order to get close to the basket to shoot and hopefully to score. And so if you're given the freedom to look for the truth, you have a corresponding responsibility, as we talked about earlier, responsibility. The responsibility is to hold on to it once you find it. Okay, even if it costs you something, even if you run into conflict with others who don't see things quite the same way you do, and others who might not be tolerant of you because you're holding on to the truth. And you have to realize that it's worth holding on to, and moreover, holding on to the truth is key to getting along with everybody else, because the truth is what unites us. We can never be united by falsehoods. And, you know, the Soviet Union was a great example of having lies enforced by government on people, and that did not lead to unity. That suppressed people for a number of years, you know, being persecuted, but it all blew up after a while, because you cannot suppress the truth and the truth of human nature.
If a listener tonight said, Mr. Godfrey, I'm in my 20s. Is there still hope for me in America? What would you say?
Oh, there's still hope for you, even if you're, you know, in that Soviet bloc that we talked about. You know, there's an old saying, hope springs eternal. I don't know where that came from. That's not spiritual. That probably came off a Hallmark card. But hope is something that exists as for as long as until we actually achieve what it is that we're hoping for. It's right up there with the three things that last forever: faith, hope, and love. So hope always exists. And what is it that gives us the hope, helps us to believe in something that we can't yet see, okay? And that's what helps us take that first step, even though we can't see the finish line, and it's faith. And so for somebody that's feeling hopeless, I would tell them to strengthen their faith. And then I would look to that person whom I've already mentioned as being the great exemplar of self-giving love.
If you want to learn more, www.lifeathletes.org. Chris, the word fear, false expectations appearing real. 88% of what we worry about never happens, yet the fear of failure paralyzes so many of us. Talk to us about fear.
Yeah, that's a great definition. I've not heard that one before. But yeah, fear is very real, and I think the best way to handle that is to look at it because, yeah, I'm being besieged by fear right now. All these thoughts, they're happening to me, and I'm suffering for that. And look at it objectively, and then once you do, You'll understand where you are and that there's nothing wrong with you for fearing, okay? But then you have to continue to look objectively, just as you said, you know, 90%, start thinking about that. You know, 90% of all these things you fear may never happen. Or, you know, before you called this morning, Jack, you know, what if this goes horribly wrong, this interview, you know, things like that. Those are things that over time, and that's why I think that sports is such a great training for young people, is that it puts you in situations where you have those kind of butterflies, you have a lot of those things, fears building up inside of you, and then and calling up the courage to face those fears. I remember my first start with the Wolverines when I was a sophomore. We had number one Texas A&M coming to town, and the biggest lesson I learned that day was having the courage to face my fear. I mean, I was so afraid I could hardly see straight, and didn't play a perfect game, but I played a good game. And so fear is a natural part of life, and just as I mentioned, we have a great exemplar in Jesus Christ. We also have his adversary who doesn't want us to succeed. The devil is real, and he's gonna make you afraid. He's going to make you quit, take yourself out of the game, make you stay in the locker room so you don't even take the field, which is the problem with a lot of young people approaching the thought of marriage. They're afraid. They can't see this working out. They see everybody else failing around them, and they're afraid. But as you said, fear is often unfounded, and even if it's real, and I would admit that it's not terribly conducive these days, marriage, that is, it's not supported in a lot of ways, but God will be with us if we take that step of faith out, and we'll have the corresponding hope to take that step if we have the faith in him that he'll be with us.
As our time winds down together this evening, what advice, final advice, would you give to our young listeners, please?
That we're made to be in good relationships with others, key to our happiness, first with God, then with others, and the relationship between a man and a woman in marriage is the closest thing this side of heaven to the relationship that we'll enjoy with our Lord in the future. And so know that and be open to that. Don't let fear of what others might think of you keep you from taking that step.
Chris Godfrey, what a shining example of a great soldier for Jesus Christ. Keep up the great, great work.
Thanks, Jack.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohom. Believe in you.